We are back. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Enter near future Britain. Citizens are constantly observed. Everything they do, say, hear, and even think is recorded by the system. It is democracy at its best, a total transparent society. This is the reality of Nick Harkaway's newest novel called Noman.
Indeed.
When a suspected dissident named Diana Hunter dies during an interrogation, it is up to Inspector Melikai Neath.
Yes.
To figure out what went wrong. What follows is an in-depth analysis of all of Diana Hunter's memories and thoughts. Noman was published by Knopf, and as you have heard a couple of times, Nick Harkaway is here. Welcome.
Hello.
All right, so Melikai Neath, who is that?
She is the inspector of the witness. The witness being the police branch of the system, which is the transparent democratic society in quotes that you just described. And her job is to figure out how this terrible thing could happen, where this woman dies in police custody.
Okay, so this is quite a novel in size and content. I have it here. I would drop it on the desk so people can hear.
Earthquake.
When did you first start developing this story and the several stories within it?
Well, I just finished my last book, Tiger Man, and everything was done, and I was like, I get to write a new book. And I said, okay, what shall I do? And it was 2014, and in the UK back then, so we were governed by David Cameron and coalition with Liberal Democrats. We were living a kind of wishy-washy centrist conservatism, and it all felt very fluffy, not necessarily great, but it was what it was, and it wasn't dramatic. And I felt that lurking inside that and inside previous governments that we'd had, there was a kind of thread of authoritarianism, which was scary. And I thought, I know, I'll do a story which, among other things, will be about surveillance, and it'll be about that, and we'll do a kind of warning about how the world could go scarily authoritarian. And I envisaged it taking a very short period of time and being quite a little book. And I was wrong, and I'd like to apologize now for taking rather a long time to issue my warning about authoritarian politics, because
right.
I really should have been faster on that. Because, I mean, certainly in Britain, we have seen in the 2016 Brexit campaign, we've seen some very nasty authoritarian language and some unpleasant nationalism surfacing, and I feel personally responsible in a way because I didn't get this out there fast enough.
How much of the technology you describe in Noman do you think will actually be available in the next 10 years?
Well, so here's the creepy thing. People ask me about this book, and one of the things they say is, what made you choose to write something that's a bit science fictional? And the answer is that pretty much all of it is now real to one degree or another. The last thing that I was sort of holding out for not being real was when they bring the woman who's died into to find out whether she's a refusenik, whether she's an anti-statist. They interrogate her using a machine that effectively reads your mind. In June, I think, last year, Professor Doris Tsao at Caltech here in the U.S. announced that she had been able with her team to retrieve a kind of passport photo quality image from the mind of a monkey. And when her colleague showed her the output from their rig, she thought he had accidentally copied and pasted the image from the in pile. So in 2014, when I started writing the book, I projected the technologies of using an MRI machine to read images from the brain into the future. There was a guy in Japan who was doing a project where he could maybe read images from your dreams, but they were blurry and strange. And there was another project that was somewhere else that was, again, maybe we can read images from the visual cortex. Now, though, we can read images from the visual cortex of the brain.
Okay, we got to walk through some terms here now that you freaked all of us out. All right, so the system. How does the system work?
So the system is a perfect rolling plebiscite democracy. There are no representatives. There's no Congress. There's no MPs. When the state needs to know what the policy should be, they go to the public and they say, what should we do? And people vote. And they vote on their phones. They vote on their desktops. They vote. You vote anytime, any place, anywhere, constantly, with everything. So at the same time, they're all being surveilled for everything. So the bargain is that you get a totally transparent population and a totally democratic state.
Okay, now, how does the witness work?
Well, so the witness is, they're the people who have access to all the surveillance feeds. And if a crime is the idea is that crime has been vastly reduced anyway, because you're just seen all the time. But when a crime happens and is complex, or when a professional crime happens, or a syndicate comes in from abroad and commits a bank robbery or something, the witness is the investigative arm, and their job is to go in and deal with complexity. Because all this is overseen in the book by I guess a set of algorithms running on a machine, but it's not an AI in the sense of like HAL from 2001. It's not conscious. There's no suggestion that it is. So you still need people in the loop. And so the people are there to go when something is complex, when it's difficult, when it's nuanced, the witness goes in and they go and sort it out. And they're counselors as well as investigators.
I should say, you're listening to Nick Harkaway, and we're talking about his fourth novel called Gnomon, published by Knopf. Okay, so how does the system get access to your thoughts and memories?
Well, so that I don't get very technical in the book because I didn't want to turn this into a technical story, but they essentially put you in a chair, they put a headset on you, and so this is a consequence of the advance of technology. I did it so that they have to implant a chip in your head and it intercepts the signals in your brain. That's no longer necessary.
Oh.
So that's the weird thing about this situation, is that I got outpaced by the technology. I could have just... The one piece of technology in the mainstream of the book that isn't real is the healing technology they use after they've operated on your brain, which I could have gotten away without having in the first place.
Well, okay, and maybe by the time this is in its second printing, that also would be addressed. Okay, who is Diana Hunter?
She is an angry old lady. This is the force that runs the world, right? Everybody knows this. Secretly, the world is run by angry old ladies. And it should be. We would be in a better situation. So she is a lady, and she has retreated from the system. And she kind of lives on a barter economy. She kind of trades old books for eggs and milk, and she runs a little kind of tiny school in her house, and she teaches kids about, you know, kind of non-digital living. She's retreated into a kind of Faraday cage. She's wired off her house so that radio signals can't pass through it, and she's just gone off the grid. And on this basis, really, they bring her in and they say, well, you know, are you an anti-state terrorist? And she's grumpy.
Simply because she's gotten,
because
living
she's,
her life off
because,
the grid.
Because the algorithm says you disappear off the system, you must be doing something wrong.
If algorithm.
You have nothing to fear, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. So they bring her in to find out whether she's a threat. And the thing is that the medical procedure that you go through when they put in the chip to read your mind and so on, it's actually physically good for you. You know, if you've got something wrong with your brain, they'll fix it at the same time. They'll everything, you come out healthier and happier. So The whole point about the system is it's supposed to be kind of attractive. And when people ask me at the moment about, because I'm talking about the book, they say, well, you know, why did you write a dystopia? And at that point, I kind of have to ask in reply whether it is a dystopia if it feels like the society they have might be slightly better than the one that we have. I mean, you know, that's a sort of slightly spooky kind of thing. You're like, I'm not sure. You have flaws. There are some definite flaws in the system, and we explore them in the book. But wow, you know, maybe. Mm.
Well, it's interesting. So if Diana Hunter is someone who is living off the grid, and she doesn't show up in any of the algorithms, but they bring her in, does she have that chip in her head?
Well, so yeah, because it's not that they just put a chip in everybody's head. It's like when they want to interrogate you, they perform an operation, a probe goes into your head. As I say, I didn't get sort of super specific about this because I didn't want to get into a technical discussion of brain science. So basically, they do some kind of operation and they read your mind.
And but
when they read her mind, they don't find her memories. They find four other people's. These other memories that can't possibly be there. And that's where the book really kicks off, because then you're in these other stories.
Yeah, there are these multiple personalities with all of these names that I am not going to pronounce. There's a Greek banker. There's an alchemist. There's an Ethiopian painter. Who else is in there? And well, why are they there?
Well, so why are they there is a good question. It's part of the question in the book, so I'm not going to answer it directly. But they're in there getting in the way is the first thing we know about them. And the question is, how can they possibly be there? You can't just put other people into your head.
Right.
So that is a problem for Neith straight away. She's supposed to be finding out whether this woman was a threat to the state. And now it turns out that she can do something impossible with the state's last line of defense against somebody planning against them. So there's an issue. And so we go into those individual stories. Konstantin Kyriakos is a banker during the financial crisis, and his story begins. He's swimming off the coast of Greece on a sports dive, and he finds himself eye to eye with a great white shark. And when he escapes, he gets back onto dry land, but the shark seems to have come with him and starts, when he looks at the screen with all the, he's a trader, he sees all the stuff on the screen, the numbers moving for the markets, and he sees the shark in the numbers, and it eats a Fortune 500 company right there. And you know, because he sees the numbers, he knows that the company's going down, so he starts making money hand over fist, and then his story changes forever.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, okay, that's the banker. So then the alchemist?
The alchemist, this is a fascinating story. So Saint Augustine of Hippo, the bishop of Hippo, the reasoner and thinker of the church, before he was a bishop, when he was in Carthage as a student, he met a woman and they became lovers and they were together for 7 years. This is all true. And they eventually had a child. And then his mother, Monica, persuaded him that he needed to put her aside and marry a good Christian girl. And then he didn't marry the good Christian girl. And he didn't marry the woman who'd had his child, and he ended up as a life of ascetic contemplation or whatever. And you can read the confessions as a 13-book breakup note to this woman, whose name is nowhere written down. We don't know who she was. She disappears into history at that moment. So I was like, okay, I'm giving this woman a story, because that's not fair. And I wanted her, you know, to have a life that was more important than his.
Oh, and that's the alchemist.
And that's the alchemist.
All right. So then, where am I? Oh, the Ethiopian painter.
Yes. So this was one of the sort of genesis points of the story. So I wanted a guy who had been an artist and wasn't anymore. So he's a grandfather when we meet him. He's living in London and he's established a kind of security company, and he's, you know, he's been successful and he's now kind of retired. And the first thing we know is that he's in a burning house and he needs to get out. And he has this weird moment where he's like, well, what I need to do to get out of this burning house is I need to remember how to walk through walls. And it transpires that when he was a painter in Ethiopia, there's a revolution in Ethiopia in the 70s, he was imprisoned, and he doesn't know how he escaped exactly. But he got out, and as he remembers it, he walked through walls to get out. So if he can do that again, but he's got to save his granddaughter who's in the house with him, so he has to remember how to do that. So we go back into his life, and all these stories are twined together. So, for example, one of his famous paintings from his period as a painter in Ethiopia is of the fin of a shark, and it's titled Gnomon. So all these stories bind together, and so Neith, as she's experiencing all these stories, and she's beginning to realize that she's being sent a message, or she's seeing through the cracks in Hunter's defenses to something that's going on in her mind.
So then I was going to ask, how do all of these people relate back to Diana? How, I know I'm asking you questions that you don't want to answer because they'll be answered in the book, but how are they there in a world where that's impossible?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to answer directly either, because I want you to be enthralled and go by the book. But the point, I think, of it is from Neith's perspective that she's being deceived on some level in a way that is impossible. And that means that the system has a flaw in it, which she can't account for, because technologically this shouldn't be something that is doable. And there's one more story that's in Hunter's head which can't possibly be there, which is the title story, the title character, which is this sort of slightly disturbing, far-flung intelligence which appears to have been sent back in time to kill the other characters in the story. And so we don't know what's going on with that. And, you know, you ask yourself, will this character succeed? But hang on, it's not true. It's just in someone's head. So there's a whole discussion about which of the stories is the primary reality. And you're fairly confident that it's Neith. But maybe you're wrong.
Maybe you're wrong. Okay, last question. Gnomon. Where does the name come from? Where does the title come from?
Well, so a gnomon is the right angle. It's like a metal set square that you use in masonry, but it's also, by extension, it's basically anything that sticks out at right angles to everything else. It's the upright part of a sundial. And the point about this book, because it's a detective story and this is the point about detectives, is what sticks out? What's the clue?
Interesting, because you mentioned the great white and the shark fin. Yes. And the whole thing. It's all coming together.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I cannot, Nick, have you sit here and not ask you whether it was natural for you to become a writer.
It was natural to me to tell stories, because in my house we tell stories as a way of saying hello. Like if you go away, like when I come home from this trip, it'll be kind of, what great stories have you got to tell? It's how we kind of relate to one another.
Yeah, how we relate to one another in your family.
In my
where
family.
It is a, you know, tradition to tell stories. Who's in your family, Nick?
Yes, it's a fair cop. My father is John le Carré, the great and renowned novelist of British life.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Did you feel any pressure?
I didn't until it's like the high wire act, until you look down. And then I was like, well, that is a very long way. And it's also, the other thing is, frustratingly, he just keeps getting better. I like sooner or later you figure he's going to knock it off, but no, he just gets better.
How did you feel when your dad read your first book?
Twitchy, little nervous. He reads a lot of nonfiction and a lot of history. So it was not that he doesn't read novels at all, but so it was sort of outside his comfort zone in possibly every single way. Something written by his son, something that is Gone Away World is a very crazy, wild sort of science fictional novel with a kind of kung fu movie pastiche going on. And this is not his natural area, you know. So I was just delighted. He started reading it and sort of came down to lunch, and I could see that he was not appalled.
Oh no!
And I was just like,
"That's all you were going
that's
for."
That's all I wanted.
Not appalled.
You know, he's like, you know, and he gets asked in interviews, you know, how do you feel about Nick writing? And his response is always, you know, kind of essentially what it is, yeah, it turns out he's okay. You know, and that'll do. I'll take it. You know, we're actually very effusive with each other. But
are you sure?
Yeah, no. But it's that Brit thing, right? It was when I lived in New York briefly in the 90s, and one of the things I had to learn to do here, I was at the New York Film Academy having an amazing time, and by then I'd already written a couple of screenplays, and so people would say kind of, oh, Nick, you've done a bit of writing. Could you maybe kind of, you know, we're doing a short film next week. Could you write the script? I'd be like, yeah, I could probably manage that. And say, oh, well, if you're not sure, then we'll get Bob to do it. I'd be like, hang on, let me just rephrase, because that was British for, yes, I can do this really well. but it's not something that comes naturally to us. So when, you know, the sort of highest praise that you can imagine in a way is sort of, you know, in public is very much kind of, yeah, no, that was okay. It was a good piece of work, you know.
and when your dad is John le Carré and you're British, and you'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. But also the thing is, in reality, genuinely, we do a lot of hugging. We're not the stereotypical British family where you're kind of like, oh, good Lord, physical contact is extraordinary. So, you know, there's a lot of hugging, a lot of, hey, that was amazing. I really liked that. So
that is terrific. You are listening to Nick Harkaway. He is here talking about his fourth novel, Gnomon. A lot going on in this book. Tonight at 7:30, Nick Harkaway will be in conversation with Jen Northington at Greenlight Bookstore. That's at 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. I'll say it again, 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. Nick Harkaway, wonderful to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.